the question. Who are the young black or Hispanic woke women out there with platforms that we can empower? That way we could directly uplift them instead of indirectly uplifting someone like Tommy. Had I done that, I believe the tweet would have immediately ignited a conversation about all the incredible women on social media who are moving the culture forward in that political pundit type space. Women who I was not only familiar with and in many cases work with, but who also I felt hadn't received the attention they deserved. But that's not what happened. Instead, I framed the tweet as "would be dope if." And immediately, things spun out of control. The narrative became Charlamagne wants women of color to be like Tommy Lauren, before quickly escalating to Charlamagne hates black women. Mind you, I never even remotely said either of those things, but once a narrative starts building, it's tough to slow it down. When a Twitter storm starts burning that hot, there's nothing to do except own that you fucked up. Yes, my intentions were good, and I felt my tweet had been misinterpreted, but I'm a professional communicator. And if I can't communicate what I'm trying to express in a clear fashion, then that's on me. That's why the very next morning, I gave myself Donkey of the Day. Because I had definitely made an ass out of myself. The donkey might have been well deserved, but Twitter wasn't going to let me live that tweet down. No matter how many times I acknowledged and apologized for my mistake, even up to this day, whenever I say something even remotely questionable, people will send me that tweet, usually with a caption like, "See, there goes Charlamagne hating on black women again." F-E-A-R. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. A quote from James Baldwin. That tweet caused me a lot of stress, but do I regret it? Not even a little bit. The great radio personality and my homie Kay Fox once told me, you have to look at fear as having two meanings. Forget everything and run, or face everything and rise. As Kay Fox explained it, that means when a situation makes you anxious, don't run from it or make excuses. Instead, your best recourse is always to face it head on. Confront any insecurities that might have been behind your actions and then try to fix them. Once you have, dust yourself off and continue to rise in your journey. And that's ultimately what happened to me after the Tommy text. Yes, I took a bad beating on social media, but I also learned a lot about the incredible work women of color were already doing on social media. Work that has really enhanced my understanding of politics and social issues. Perhaps most important, that situation also led to me becoming better friends with my spiritual sister, the uber-talented political commentator Angela Rye. Angela was one of the main people Twitter told me was already building platforms and doing work. To her credit, instead of being insulted by my ignorance, Angela reached out to me with real empathy. "I understood what you were trying to say," she tweeted me, "but it definitely didn't come out right." That's all my dumbass needed. Someone smarter than me who understood what I was trying to say and instead of crushing me, pointed me in the right direction. Angela has the type of voice I was trying to call for in that tweet. My man Van Lathan of TMZ calls her the warrior goddess of woke. And that phrase couldn't be more accurate. I love nothing more than watching her destroy colonizers on CNN, obliterate white devils on social media, and keep the Breakfast Club audience on point with what I call her monthly State of the Unions. She's one of the best strategists I know and always has a plan to make something positive happen for black people. So even though I still get little anxiety pangs whenever someone brings up that tweet, getting the connection with Angela makes up for the Category 5 tsunami that came after it. Life before the internet. So much of the anxiety we feel today is rooted in social media. In fact, I guarantee social media is the number one cause of anxiety on the planet. In theory, it's there to help us stay connected. In reality, however, it often ends up making us feel alone and even depressed. We can lose a lot of that self-inflicted stress if we can remember that we were able to survive, not to mention thrive, without it. It might shock millennials to hear this, but I still can remember what it was like before our lives ran through our phones and we were actually able to find our way around without Google Maps or Waze. We'd have to figure out where we were going by observing the landscape and sometimes just getting lost. Someone might say, "Drive on East Main Street, Pass Howard's. Keep going till you see First Baptist Church, and then turn left on South Live Oak Drive. Keep driving till you see a big field, and then the house will be just after it on the right. Directions like that forced us to pay attention. Maybe we'd make a few wrong turns and eventually pull over to the side of the road and look at a map or ask directions at a gas station, but we'd get to where we had to go. We also didn't have the internet to take the place of our memory. We had to actually learn and memorize things, which wasn't always fun. But I can still tell you about a history report I wrote in ninth grade. And we made stuff with our hands. In the ninth grade, I made a Captain Caveman Club in home ed class and carried it around school with me for protection. No one could say anything because I made it in school. Research meant time in a library, not on your phone. And you know what happens when you spend hours in a library? You end up reading books. Maybe even books you weren't expecting to be interesting. Or those outside your life experience. If you wanted to call a friend or your mother, you had to have those phone numbers memorized. You didn't have your entire contact list at your fingertips. I bet most people listening to this right now don't know their mother's phone number by heart. That would have been unthinkable back in the day. Those might seem like small points, but collectively they made our brain stronger. All those tasks, directions, challenges, and problems acted as mental exercises, the type that we aren't getting anymore. As a result, our brain muscles are getting soft. But much more important than having to figure out how to read a map or calculate sales tax, back in the day before social media, we used to do things together in person, face to face instead of on FaceTime. The God, Raekwon the Chef, once rapped, "It's for real though. Let's connect, politic, ditto." Those words still resonate with me over 20 years later, because that's what our lives revolved around back then. Politic was slang for physically getting together with your people and kicking it. You would link up, maybe roll a few blunts and start building. That was slang for having a real in-depth discussion about a topic. Or depending on how many blunts got rolled, multiple topics. It was a critical way for us to learn about things from our peers and develop our philosophies on life. While there's plenty of political debate happening on social media, there's not nearly enough politicking going on anymore. Young people don't seem interested in having conversations in person these days. I used to spend hours with my crew sitting on porches, hanging out in basements, or chilling by the ball fields while we argued over everything under the sun. Whether my cousin really asked that cute girl in science class out on a date. Whether Mobb Deep was better than Outkast. How Magic managed to keep playing with HIV/AIDS. Whether Tupac was still alive. You might start out arguing with one person, but it was only a matter of time before everyone else would jump in and add their 2 cents. If you made a good point, you might get cheers and pounds. If you said something whack or told a joke that fell flat, you would definitely get clowned. Those politicking sessions made you feel like a verbal gladiator stepping into the arena. You had to learn how to bring the heat or get scorched yourself. Those countless hours taught me to be a more confident public speaker. There's no way I would have succeeded in media without that trial by fire. I also enjoyed listening to great speakers and storytellers. One of the reasons I started studying the 5% of teachings of Islam was because of the authority those brothers spoke with in front of a crowd. I aspired to be that articulate, to possess knowledge, wisdom, and understanding of myself, and to be able to share it with others, the type of authority you can never convey through a text or a post. To truly reach people, you have to keep your mental sword sharp. Unfortunately, social media is no way to hone a blade. It's mostly one-way conversations. Ironically, this is why I sometimes miss dealing drugs. I don't miss running from the cops, worrying about getting robbed by other dealers, or knowing I was damaging my community, but I do miss, if I'm being honest, the camaraderie. I didn't play any organized sports growing up. Only hustling gave me the bond that comes with a group of people being together and playing for the same team, facing the same obstacles together. My crew and I ate together, made runs to the store together, fought together, got drunk and high together, and played cat and mouse with the cops together. Through all of that, we kept up a running conversation in which we discussed women, politics, clothes, TV, movies, comics, our families, and since more than a few of us were wannabe rappers, even ideas for songs. We also talked each other off the ledge when it came to acts we felt went too far, like committing armed robberies. The things we bonded over might not have all been positive, but there's no denying the strength of the connection. I'm sorry, but you can't get that sort of bond from a group chat. I'm on some fire group chats, but they couldn't even remotely match the bond I experienced with my crew. Physically sharing an experience just takes things to another level. Young people today prefer to text when they communicate with each other, but I think that is going to come back to haunt them. If you're going to do everything through your phone, at least call people and hear their voices. Having conversations for hours with our friends on the phone was pivotal in building social skills. All those bills we rang up, waxing poetic to the ladies, strengthened our ability to communicate our feelings, desires, and dreams. Skills that are necessary to evolve into a mature and happy adult. There's no way texting emojis and GIFs can improve your ability to communicate with other people. You can't fully express how you're feeling in a relationship with emojis. Just like you're not going to be able to use GIFs and emojis in a job interview. And if you are, then we're probably all screwed. I've had a gut feeling for the last several years that social media is getting in the way of people making true, lasting connections. Now the science is backing me up. According to Psychology Today, a new study from the University of Oxford reaffirms the importance of cultivating and nurturing friendships with face-to-face contact. The researchers found that using social media exclusively to interact with close friends may inadvertently cause the bonds of these friendships to weaken. The article goes on to say that although people may have more friends now thanks to social media, they actually have less people they think they could turn to in a crisis or lean on for emotional support. Sue Fudge, one of the study's authors, adds, "Although social media may seem like the perfect way to make and maintain friendships, this research shows that face-to-face interaction is essential for truly authentic relationships, and that shares, selfies, and likes are no replacement for the bonding that takes place while sharing food, experiences, and anecdotes." Amen. I'm not saying that everyone needs a crew of drug dealers to create those bonds with, but you do need a crew that you can build with in person. That's why I'm trying to make a concerted effort to do more activities with my friends face to face. One way is having people over for dinner and letting them spend time with my family. That's something I was hesitant to do in the past, but I'm realizing that attitude was counterproductive. There's a real bond that's built when families interact. It's very important for generations to mix so that lessons can be handed down. Hanging out with other like-minded families is how I want my kids to learn how to socialize, cook, laugh, dance, and love, not by watching some stranger do them online. Hanging out with people is critical. There's nothing I love more than a Red Cup kickback with friends and family. They provide my family a much more realistic sense of how people live than being online. To have social media tell it, everyone looks great, wears fashionable clothes, drives nice cars, takes vacations to amazing places, and is always surrounded by beautiful people. As my Mount's Corner brother, Pastor Stephen Furtick, says regarding the dangers of social media, "One reason we struggle with insecurity, we're comparing our behind the scenes to everyone else's highlight reel. When we spend countless hours each week scrolling through people's IG and Facebook accounts, our own lives can start to feel very insignificant or uninspiring by comparison. As we start to get further into the social media age, studies are beginning to prove what a lot of us have already been saying." In Denmark, researchers found that frequent users begin to develop what they call Facebook envy. Essentially, they get so caught up in the fun other people seem to be having on Facebook that their ability to enjoy their own lives begins to decline. Over time, that envy begins to morph into depression and decreased life satisfaction. Not surprisingly, the study found when the participants stayed off Facebook for just a week, their emotions became much more positive and their satisfaction in their own lives increased. The connection between unhappiness and social media is particularly strong among teenagers. A study for the American Psychological Association found evidence that the more time teens spent on social media, the less happy they were. We found that teens who spent more time seeing their friends in person, exercising, playing sports, attending religious services, reading, or even doing homework were happier, said Gene Twinge, a professor of psychology at San Diego State, in an article for Vice. However, teens who spent more time on the internet, playing computer games, on social media, texting, using video chat, or watching TV were less happy. The study had bad news for adults, too. According to Professor Twinge, adults over the age of 30 are less happy than they were 15 years ago. To compound that, or maybe because of it, those adults are also having less sex. While the author admits that there could be several factors behind the decrease in happiness, there's no doubt that it's connected to the fact that adults are spending more time than ever on screens. Professor Twin says that for teenagers, it's important that they limit the time they spend on their phones. That's because teens who spend more than 5 hours a day on smartphones are 71% more likely to develop risk factors for suicide. That's a really scary number. Professor Twin says the ideal amount of time for teens to spend on phones every day is between a half an hour and an hour. Even up to 2 hours can be okay. But once a teen starts spending over 3 hours a day on their phone, it can be a serious threat to their mental health. Addicted to algorithms. I can talk all day about not basing your love life on swipes or the importance of creating relationships that aren't exclusive to your phone, but I also concede that it's often easier said than done. That's because most of us, to some degree or another, suffer from a form of addiction to social media. And like any addiction, it can bring a tremendous amount of stress and anxiety into your life. On a scale of 1 to Whitney and Bobby in the 90s, I personally fall closer to a I get high a little more than I should than straight up crackhead. I still definitely have a problem, though. I'm never going to completely break my dependency on phones, which I've accepted are a necessary evil, especially when you have a family. There are a lot of instances where I need to communicate with my wife and children, and obviously a cell phone makes that much easier. One of the reasons I love going on vacation is because when I have my entire family physically around me, then I don't need my phone anymore. There's no emergency or sudden change in plans that I need to be alerted to. When we go to the beach, I leave my phone in the safe in our room. I feel the urge to check my texts or my mentions on Twitter, but spending time with the people I love is a stronger motivation and I get past it. I found that when I'm on vacation, I can wean myself off my phone for at least a few hours at a time, which allows me to focus my attention where it belongs. My day-to-day life, however, is a different story. It's still a struggle for me to stay off my phone for more than a few minutes. I have my phone in my hand a lot of times for no reason at all, like taking it into the bathroom when I go pee. That's right, I pee with my phone in my left hand and dick in my right. For what? Just so I can scroll through social media for 15 seconds? Don't get me wrong, Twitter on the shitter is acceptable because that's like reading a book or a magazine. But Twitter while peeing, that's when you know you're a broadband basehead. One time, I actually dropped my phone in the toilet while I was peeing. As soon as I fished it out, I put it in a bag of rice because for some strange reason, that is a home remedy that really works when you drop your phone in water. I used that method twice and still used the rice. Even after I dropped the phone in the toilet, my brilliant idiot logic tells me the boiling water will kill the germs, so why waste perfectly good rice? Even after drying the phone in the rice, I still needed to wait till the next morning to take it into the store to get looked at. Those hours without my phone felt like agony. I've never had a major organ give out on me, but it felt like that's what happened. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to survive. The entire time I was waiting for it to be fixed, I was stressing about what I was missing out on. Was my wife trying to get in touch with me? Was something wrong with our kids? Did my manager have urgent news on a deal we'd been working on? Was Twitter blowing up over some scandal I wouldn't be in the loop about? Had one of my tweets gotten 1,000 retweets and I was missing out on the chance to bask in the glory of my accomplishment? All those questions kept racing through my mind. Of course, when I finally did get my phone back, nothing earth-shattering had happened at all. Yes, I had received some texts and emails, but nothing that had to be handled immediately. Sure, Twitter had blown up over something, but when isn't that happening? There was nothing I needed to chime in on. In that moment, I wondered, why did I feel like stress was eating me alive? Nothing serious happened. I hadn't missed out on shit. FOMO. Social media is training us to compare our lives instead of appreciating everything we are. No wonder why everyone is always depressed. Quote from Bill Murray. Fear of missing out, or FOMO, is what drives so much of our collective social media anxiety. We all think social media is where the party is, Gay, straight, black, white, thugs, theater nerds, sports fans, political fanatics, new parents, grandparents, dog lovers, cat lovers, Republicans, Democrats, libertarians, it doesn't matter. Social media is like one big popping party that never ends, and everyone is invited. If you're not there, you feel like you are missing out. Not to mention, this forever lit party doesn't have a bouncer and doesn't charge a cover. Only on social media can some digital dickhead sitting in his underwear in the basement of his mom's house in New Mexico find himself having a conversation with Diddy. Who doesn't want to hang out at a club like that every night? Sure as hell beats whatever's happening in that basement. But like any party, it's only healthy in small doses. You can't spend your entire day on the digital dance floor. You can't head to the bar for another drink every hour. You can't spend your entire life trying to get into the VIP room. You have to accept that you're going to miss out on a lot of that party. Most of it, in fact, if you want to stay functional in the rest of your life. You see what happens to people who party too much in real life. It's no different with the social media party. Instead of, what am I missing out on? The question you need to start asking yourself is, how can I refocus on what is actually happening in my life? The answer is like with any addiction. You need to take baby steps one day at a time. The first step is to think of your phone as a tool, not a part of you. It can be very useful, but you don't need it. When you wake up, the first thing you do shouldn't be pick up your phone to see who texted you while you were asleep. If that's what you do, acknowledge it and then create a different ritual. When I wake up at 4:30 in the morning after going to pee with both hands free, I come back to my room and take a few minutes to pray. I make sure to thank God for another day and then ask for divine protection for myself, family, and friends. Then I take a shower. Next, I sit down and read a couple pages from one of my daily affirmation books. Currently, the two I'm using are The Daily Stoic by Ryan Holiday and Your Best Life Begins Each Morning by Joel Osteen. After giving my wife and kids a quick kiss goodbye while they sleep, I get in my truck to drive into work. In the past, I used to listen to hip-hop on the way in. But lately I've been riding in silence. I want to use that 40 or so minutes to let my brain be still. I may listen to Oprah's Super Soul Conversations podcast or Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History because I can learn things from those programs. I also listen to sermons by one of my favorite pastors like John Gray, Carl Lynch, or Stephen Furtick. What I won't listen to is anything that's going to plant negative seeds in my mind. Not until I get to work at 6 a.m. do I look at my phone. No texts, no calls, no emails until I walk in that studio. You might say, bro, you're still on your phone at 6 a.m., but remember, I've already been up for an hour and a half. When was the last time you waited an hour and a half after you woke up to look at your phone? I bet it's been a while. I wait because I've come to understand the first move in the morning sets the tone for the rest of the day. It reflects what's most important to you. I simply refuse to put my phone in the same routine as prayer, receiving positive affirmations, and kissing my wife and kids. I might have an issue, but my addiction isn't that strong. Don't read the comments. I do struggle with it enough that recently I asked my therapist for advice on how to spend less time on social media, especially reading comments about myself. Her advice was so simple that I felt stupid for even asking. Why do you have to be honest? She asked me. I mumbled something like, easier said than done. Is this what I pay you $150 an hour for? But honestly, she was right. Why do you have to read the comments on your pages? She continued. What is it you're looking for? Do you think someone's going to tell you something about yourself that you don't already know? Of course not. You don't have to choose to be on them. Her last statement really made me think. We've gotten to a point where we feel like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat are necessary parts of our lives. It's not true. We make the choice to be on them. Once we do, however, we lose the right to complain about their effect on us. If you go to the same restaurant over and over but always complain about the food after each meal, ultimately the problem doesn't lie with the restaurant. It lies with your decision-making skills. Yeah, maybe the first time you ate there was okay. But if you spend the rest of the night on the toilet every time after that, then stop going back. It's the same with social media. MySpace was cool back in the day. It allowed us to connect with people, hear their music, and keep up with their lives. But it wasn't on our phones. We barely had laptops then, so you had to be on a desktop in your office or at home to even log on. The only time I'd be on MySpace was late at night when I usually wouldn't be interacting with other people anyway. I would go to someone's page, maybe look at pictures, listen to some music, and then keep it moving. I never feared I was missing out on anything that happened there. I checked in when I wanted to, not when I thought I had to. The shift started after apps like Twitter and Facebook became compatible with phones. At first, I resisted joining Twitter, but Little Duval kept telling me to get on it. I had just got fired from Wendy Williams' radio show and was unemployed, so it was literally something to pass time when I had nothing else to do, which was more often than I liked. I would tweet things out, but I didn't know people could reply to them. So for months, I was essentially talking to myself until one day I hit that at reply button. And suddenly I saw I had mentions and replies to my tweets. That's when things changed. Suddenly it felt like I had an audience. There was a real sense of call and response. It was intoxicating that I could write something and get an immediate reaction. Same thing with Instagram. I could post pictures and people leave comments in real time. I could get an immediate sense of validation, of acceptance, of action. That's when it started to feel like I was a part of something bigger than me. The feeling of never having to be alone was addictive. What we're learning today is that it's important to be alone sometimes, especially with your thoughts. It's not healthy to go from reading an article about something to seeing people's tweets about it, to listening to a podcast about it. It's information overload. We need to step back more. Please realize that it's okay to have downtime with yourself. Creating that time can be something as active as meditating or as passive as commuting in silence. You might feel like you're missing out on something on social media, but what you really might be missing out on are your best ideas. Often our greatest ideas are born in silence. Why do you think a lot of people come up with amazing things while they're taking a shower? Because there's no distractions in there. In those minutes of silence without your phone, you can reflect. You can get in touch with your thoughts and take stock of what's happening in your life. The key is to extend those minutes of reflection and silence throughout your day. But my God, once they make a phone that you can take in there, we really will be addicted to algorithms. See if you can train yourself to put your phone down when you come home from work and limit yourself to how many times you check it. If setting it on your kitchen table is too tempting, then put it in a drawer or box. Only let yourself check it once before you go to bed. That probably sounds impossible, but if you do it a couple times, you'll find it's not too hard. Then build on that by undergoing a social media detox. That's right. Just like it's important to detox from alcohol or unhealthy foods from time to time, you need to do the same with social media. You can start by going through your phone and deleting one app that you're currently using but isn't essential. You don't have to start with Twitter or Instagram. Pick something that you use but in the back of your mind, know you don't really need. Then a month later, pick another one. Keep going and building momentum until you're able to delete one of the big ones. If that feels too hard, you can install an app that limits the time you can spend on social media. When I'm writing, I like an app called Freedom, which blocks all websites and apps. It's like an airport setting for your apps. Or you can try apps like Break Free or Moments that will allow you to use apps, but only for a limited amount of time. It might seem counterintuitive to use an app to break your addiction to apps, but if that's what it takes, don't fight it. You will likely feel actual withdrawal symptoms. Remember, these apps are designed by computers to keep you hooked. Even crack doesn't have that going for it. Notice that if you stay off some of these apps longer than usual, they'll start sending you reminders. Hey, check out how many notifications you've missed. Hey, you've got a new friend. The algorithms can tell you're starting to stray, and the apps will do everything within their power to bring you back. It's like a drug dealer waving a free sample in your face when he hasn't seen you on the block for a minute. It's not going to be as simple as just walking away. You're going to have to fight the urge, often created by the app itself, to jump back on your phone and check in with the bullshit. It will be hard, but it will be worth it too. Think about how many hours you waste scrolling through hot takes that are really lukewarm and arguments you don't care about. What if you replace that time with going to the gym, learning how to cook, or even just taking a walk? Think about how much better your life would be in a few months. Even better still, use the time you were spending on social media to be with your family. No amount of likes, no number of retweets, no amount of followers will ever come close to making you happier than spending time with the people you love or getting to meet the person you will come to love. If you take one thing from this book, let it be that.
So anxious. Clinical Correlation by Dr. Ish. The vivid description of Charlemagne's first panic attack goes straight to the core of the intense fear that every person with anxiety or panic has ever felt. They're going to die. In that moment of panic, we look for something that's happening simultaneously to blame for this feeling, no matter how illogical it may be, because we're battling for our very survival. Then we try to connect the object of our blame with something from our past that's made us feel a similar way, in order to help the association make sense in our minds, even if there isn't a connection. Then our brains spring forward and desperately try to figure out, is this problem going to be permanent? Is this going to happen every time I do something like this? And is this feeling going to stay with me and ultimately limit me in life from doing the things I want to do? The real answer to that question is a resounding no. Unfortunately, it's hard to reach that conclusion when your mind and body are being riddled with anxiety symptoms that you have no idea how to make go away. Our brains begin to automatically make false connections between what we're thinking and feeling. Then our emotions make false associations between what we're feeling and actually doing. And so the pathological pattern begins. Automatic thoughts leading to false assumptions, leading to misguided emotions. This creates one of the most common types of anxiety called anticipatory anxiety. We're expecting the worst, even though the situation and our symptoms don't indicate it. Before moving forward, let's be clear on exactly what anxiety means. Everybody worries. Everybody gets nervous. Just because you get anxious sometimes doesn't mean you have an anxiety disorder, of which there are many types. The tool we use as psychiatrists to diagnose anxiety and other mental health disorders is called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM-5 for short. Here, anxiety is defined specifically as the presence of excessive anxiety and worry about a variety of topics, events, or activities that occur more often than not for at least 6 months and is clearly excessive. This means you worry even when there's nothing to worry about. Or your worrying is extremely exaggerated in relation to the risk you actually face. You spend a lot of time per day worrying about things and will often seek reassurance from others. You find it difficult to control this worry and are experiencing at least 3 of the following emotional or physical symptoms. Restlessness or feeling on edge. Tiring easily, more fatigued than usual. Poor concentration or feeling as though the mind goes blank. Irritability, which may or may not be observable to others. Increased muscle aches or soreness. Poor sleep. Trouble falling asleep or staying asleep. Restlessness at night or sleep that's not restful. Sweating, nausea, or diarrhea. And because of this worry, you now find it hard to carry out day-to-day activities and responsibilities, and it may spill over and cause problems in your relationships at work or in other important areas. There is no medical condition that's causing these symptoms, even though there are many medical conditions that can mimic these conditions, such as cardiac or gastrointestinal problems, and the symptoms are not due to the effect of substances, including prescription medication, alcohol, or recreational drugs. Also, smoking the wrong type of marijuana. And as any anxiety sufferer will tell you, any one of these symptoms can open the floodgates for all the other symptoms to come rushing through in what can feel like an endless feedback loop that, at its absolute worst, makes you think you're going to die. The great thing Charlemagne was able to do during his first panic attack is what every good therapist will encourage: trace the problem to its source. What I've learned as a psychiatrist is that the source of most mental problems starts much earlier than when you start to notice symptoms. A big takeaway from this chapter is understanding the pathway anxiety takes to manifest in our minds. The day we as children realize that we're unique or different can be both the most incredible and most tragic day of our lives. Understanding that I'm different and I'm me should feel amazing. And it usually does, right up until the moment you realize everyone won't accept you for being you. And then it doesn't. And at this stage of mental development in our pre-adult and often pre-teen brains, the last thing we want to do is stand out. We want to be a part of the group. We want to be accepted. We want to fit in, wear the same cool clothes, listen to the same cool music, sit at the same cool kids' table, do the things that cool kids do. And to that end, we'll go out of our way to hide the fact that, yes, indeed, I'm not like the rest of them. The irony here is that we're all the same and that every single one of us has had this same realization and experienced this sense of longing to belong. The true difference as we grow up is seen in what vehicles, positive or negative, we choose to achieve that belonging. Charlemagne hid in the wooded area of his neighborhood to be alone with his differences, gathered himself, put his mask back on, and rejoined the group. We all wear a mask, then and now. Whether it's in the form of doing things you know you shouldn't in order to fit in, liking people or posts you don't particularly care for because everyone else does, or worse yet, disliking people simply because everyone you think you identify with does so too. Think about the things we've surrounded ourselves with since we were kids just to belong. T-ball, soccer, cheer, dance, sports, fraternities, sororities, neighborhoods, political affiliations. I can say with utmost certainty that at some point you found yourself trying to belong to a group that deep down you knew really didn't suit you. 90% of the decisions we make in life, what to wear, what to eat, what to be, where to live, even who to love, are based on how we imagine our peer group will react. Think about that. When the things you think, feel, and consequently do don't match up with who you are inside, we call that incongruence. It creates internal conflict, and that internal struggle comes out in the most peculiar and sometimes horrific ways. The goal of any good therapist is to help you resolve that internal conflict and become truly comfortable in your own skin without any mask at all. Clinically, we call that being integrated. Integration goes a long way to resolving your anxiety. Another of the critical take-home messages here is that in order to grow up to be an emotionally healthy, well-adjusted adult, every child has to have a degree of certainty maintained throughout their childhood. When kids go to bed at night and wake up in the morning, they need to know they're going to be okay. In addition to the day we realize we're different, the other tragic day that can happen in a child's life is the day we realize that certainty is lost. For Charlemagne, this came in the form of a natural disaster. But for a lot of kids, it can be more generic things. Mom and dad arguing or fighting. Either parent not being there. Divorce. Death of a close family member. Illness. A household with a high level of emotional expression or a drama-filled family. Just being plain broke and growing up in a financially unstable household. Anything that triggers a kid to think, everything's not okay, will suffice to inject their first sense of uncertainty in the world and introduce them to their first pang of anxiety. A child's pre-adult mind processes the world internally, so a child will innately look inward for the answers to the poor questions that his or her child brain is asking to figure out why these things are happening. Why did the storm take our house away? Why did Mom get sick? Why doesn't Dad love me enough to come around? Why don't they love me enough to stay together? Why did Mommy's new friend touch my privates? What did I do wrong to make them go away? What did I do wrong to make this bad thing happen to me? Unfortunately, your brain will look to solve any question you ask it, good, bad, or otherwise. So it is of the utmost importance that you ask yourself only good questions. Ask a poor question, and your brain has no choice but to give you an equally poor and useless answer. The answer to all these horrible kid questions of uncertainty leads one inexorably to the damning conclusion. This bad thing happened to me because who I am isn't enough. I'm bad. I'm not good enough. I'm not going to have everything I need in this world to be okay. And then we freak out. Bam. Anxiety.
Chapter 3. Blackanoid. I think anxiety is also something that I'm just now being exposed to. A really big conversation and idea that I'm getting introduced to right now is black mental health. Because for a long time, that wasn't a thing that we talked about. A quote from Chance the Rapper. Anxiety and blackness seems to go hand in hand. It's like African Americans have permanent PTSD that dates back to slavery. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a condition usually associated with soldiers who have a difficult time adjusting to civilian life because of the terrible things they've witnessed during war. A vet who might still die for cover every time a car backfires, or gets flashbacks of his tank blowing up every time he smells gas when he's filling up his car, or has vivid dreams about his buddies getting killed every time he goes to sleep. PTSD is about feeling lingering trauma from a past experience. And from going to therapy and learning more about mental health, I feel like it has to be a big piece of my anxiety and part of the story of being Black in America. This is how the National Institute of Mental Health defines the condition. PTSD is a disorder that develops in some people who have experienced a shocking, scary, or dangerous event. Nearly everyone will experience a range of reactions after trauma, yet most people recover from initial symptoms naturally. Those who continue to experience problems may be diagnosed with PTSD. People who have PTSD may feel stressed or frightened even when they are not in danger. While PTSD is often associated with soldiers, it is definitely not limited to people who served in wars. There's plenty of traumatic stress experienced by people during their day-to-day lives here in America, especially Black people. The damage isn't just limited to contemporary events either. The traumatic legacy of slavery is still felt by African Americans hundreds of years later. I know there are going to be people on the right who hear that and will claim I'm practicing victimology, or simply tell me and other Black folks to get over it already. To them, I would like to say, suck my 7.5-inch dick, 8 inches in the summer, because inherited trauma is real. Consider this. A few years ago, researchers at New York's Mount Sinai Hospital did a study on a group of Holocaust survivors and their children. The study found that the children of the survivors had stress levels in their genes that couldn't be attributed to the relatively healthy and untroubled lives they were living in America. The gene changes in the children could only be attributed to Holocaust exposure in the parents, said lead researcher Rachel Yehuda. This idea that a parent can pass trauma to a child in subsequent generations is called epigenetic inheritance. The researchers studied other groups that weren't exposed to extreme stress, but didn't find any other examples of trauma being passed down through genetics. They must not have studied any Black folks then, because there is no question in my mind that just as with those Holocaust survivors, the trauma of slavery has been passed down generation to generation in my family. There's no way that generations of people can be robbed, cheated, humiliated, lied to, and killed without it having a physical impact on their descendants. I hope they do more studies on this phenomenon, but this time, testing some descendants of American systemic racism. Fight or flight. One of our most primitive functions is what's known as the fight or flight response. It represents the choice we face each time we enter in what we perceive to be a dangerous situation. So we stick around and fight or haul ass out of there in flight. The fight or flight response was incredibly useful back in the day when we were out on the savannah hunting for food. Let's say you came upon a gazelle. Your fight or flight would process the information and then probably tell your brain to grab a spear and go get your dinner. But if you came around a bend and saw a sleeping lion, it would immediately tell you to break out of there and don't look back, unless you wanted to become dinner yourself. The fight or flight response also changes your body chemistry to make sure you're physically amped up enough to get out of the situation. If you needed to run from a lion, the fight or flight response would immediately start pumping stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol into your bloodstream. Those are the chemicals that allow you to run faster or fight harder than you thought you could when you need to survive. Here's the thing. Despite their potentially life-saving qualities, adrenaline and cortisol are not necessarily healthy for you in the long term. Because of their power, those hormones are also extremely toxic and stay in your body for several days after they're released. You only want them flowing through your blood when it's absolutely necessary. The problem for Black folks is that our fight or flight senses have gotten knocked completely out of whack since we were forcibly brought here to America as slaves. Hundreds of years of being slandered, harassed, targeted, and murdered for nothing other than having dark skin has left our fight or flight response turned all the way up. We're living in a modern society, yet we constantly find ourselves back on the proverbial savannah. Except now, we're the only ones being hunted. We keep pumping all those toxins into our body on a daily basis, even though we don't need them, and it's making us sick. This is how Deborah Barksdale, a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, describes the dangerous effect that toxicity can have on African Americans. Whether it's related to the pressures from society, increased chances of being stopped by the authorities, trying to provide for their families, or trying to find a job or to sustain a job, when a stressor occurs, there are physiological processes that occur in the brain that trigger the release of cortisol. What we have found was in certain people who are constantly stressed, cortisol levels do not go down throughout the day. It will remain high. When your stress levels are chronically high, it can create all sorts of lasting damage. Physically, it can lead to diabetes, which African-American men are almost twice as likely to develop as white men. It can also dramatically increase your blood pressure, which might explain why, according to the American Heart Association, the prevalence of high blood pressure in African-Americans is the highest in the world. No wonder that African-Americans are 1.5 times more likely to die of heart disease than whites. Chronic stress can also lead to anxiety. There's no question the stress I experienced as an African-American, especially a poor one growing up in the South, has directly led to my issues with anxiety. For a long time, I didn't want to admit that, but thankfully now I'm at a place in my life where I can face my anxiety head on. By understanding where it's rooted, I can also figure out how to get past it, to get better. Getting better, I should add, naturally. When African-Americans do manage to see a mental health professional with symptoms of PTSD like anxiety, loneliness, and insomnia, it seems like too often we are given some type of medication and then sent on our way. While some conditions do require medication, it shouldn't be your first or only choice. As my therapist told me when I first discussed my anxiety, you don't need medicine. You need someone to talk to. I think that may be true for so many of us. I believe that being black in America has been a major source of PTSD and anxiety for almost my entire life. From a kid growing up in a trailer on a dirt road in South Carolina to a rich so-called celebrity living in a beautiful home, I found that people's reaction to my skin color has always led to feelings of unease, confusion, and paranoia. Feeling in the air. Like many African Americans, I've experienced more than my fair share of shocking, scary, or dangerous events, and most of them have involved the police. Dealing with the police has always been traumatic for me, and it's partially my fault. As a teenager, I was selling crack and carrying guns, which practically ensured that my interactions with the cops were going to be stressful. Knowing that I could be arrested at any moment kept me in a state of constant anxiety. I mean, I was selling crack while I was on probation, no less. If I got caught, I was going straight to prison. How could I not be worried? My method for coping with that fear was to try to never be sober. Alcohol gave me liquid courage, but that wasn't ideal because you can't be on the block drunk as fuck. You have to have your wits about you. All my homies smoke weed, and I tried, but I had zero tolerance for it. I must have been smoking some sativa back then, too, because the paranoia the weed induced was like pouring gasoline on the flames my anxiety was already stoking. It all came to a head one day when I was around 18 years old. I had tried to cut way down on smoking because I was on probation for a charge of presenting a firearm. That was my version of being responsible. On this particular day, however, I got really high right before I punched the clock for my shift at the crack spot. Why, I do not know. As the rest of my crew joked around, I got an overwhelming feeling that the cops were going to show up and bust us. "Yo, I think the police coming today," I told my guys, trying my hardest to sound chill. "Maybe we should shut it down." "Be quiet, man. You're bugging," my partner Jarrell told me dismissively. "You're just high. Relax. Everything's good." Relax was the last thing I could do. As my crew casually watched for approaching fiends, I was overwhelmed with a sense that the cops were coming any second. When no one was looking, I slipped out the back door and into the woods behind the house, where I quickly buried my dope under a tree near the side of the yard. Then I left and went to my mom's house to cool out. But then at home, I was too anxious to sit still, so against my gut, I decided to go back to the trap. When I returned, things felt different. It was as if I was viewing the world through a movie camera. The cars driving down the street appeared to me like they were moving in slow motion. I began to focus on little details I would usually ignore. A bird sitting on a telephone wire, a leaf falling from a tree, or a squirrel bouncing across the lawn. It was like I was in a trance. I know some of you must be saying to yourself, "Nigga, you were just high as fuck. That weed must have been laced with something." But I promise you it wasn't that. Everyone else had smoked the same weed as me, but none of my folks were in the same state as I was. None of them were gripped by the same paranoia that had a hold over me. And if they were, they sure weren't acting like me. As I stood in my stupor, a fiend we knew named PJ pulled up. After we sold him his dope, I noticed he was holding a plastic Easter egg, the kind you would hide jelly beans in when you were a kid. "What's that for?" I asked him. "Oh, just something I keep my dope in," PJ replied. As soon as he said that, two undercover vans came barreling into our driveway. We've been set up. Jarrell, my cousin Anthony, and I took off running. After getting through the woods, we headed to Jarrell's cousin's house and laid low there. I knew the cops weren't chasing me anymore, but even after I stopped and sat under a tree, I still couldn't calm down. All I could think about was how close I'd come to violating my probation, how close I'd been to going back to jail, of incurring my father's wrath again, of making my mother cry again. We stayed at Jarrell's cousin's house for a couple of hours until I was finally able to breathe normally. It wasn't that I was physically exhausted. I was emotionally broke down. All the paranoia that came with selling crack had finally caught up to me. The constant fear of getting arrested. The never-ending worry that someone from your crew might be underselling you or stealing your money on the low. Or even worse, that another dealer was going to rob you for your dope and maybe even kill you in the process. Unfortunately, I never realized just how damaged I'd become. Instead, like so many young African-American men caught up on the street, I thought how I was feeling was normal, part of the game. Being paranoid, we actually used to think was something positive. We took it as a sign that we were being on point. Or as Jay-Z would say, when the streets is watching, blocks keep clocking, waiting for you to break, make your first mistake. Looking back on it, many of the songs from that era we considered hustler anthems were really textbook examples of people with undiagnosed anxiety crying out for help. I'm talking about Jay-Z's Creatures Watching, Beanie Siegel's Feel It in the Air, or Black Eyed Peas' Anxiety. Go back and listen to them. You'll see that they were all about anxiety. Clearly, I wasn't alone, even though I thought I was. To protect and make paranoid. The anxiety I suffered related to selling drugs might have been self-inflicted, but the paranoia I've experienced in my encounters with police as an adult hasn't been. I've gone out of my way to make my dealings with police as infrequent as possible. When they do occur, I couldn't be more respectful and mindful of following their instructions. Yet every single interaction still fills my heart with dread and makes me shook. If you're not black, when you see a cop in your rearview mirror, you probably do a quick mental checklist. Am I driving over the speed limit? Did I make an illegal turn? Do I have weed on me? Have I been drinking? Are any of my taillights out? If the answers to those questions are no, then you probably exhale and wait for the cops to pass you. When you're black, even if the answers are no, you'll still be breathing heavy and gripping the wheel. When a cop pulls up behind me, I immediately become extremely agitated. My mind starts flashing to every story about a routine traffic stop that ended with a black person dead. The thought of those images makes me nervous as hell, which in turn makes me feel like I'm doing something wrong. I start to question all my actions. Am I going too slow? Or should I try to stay exactly at the speed limit? Should I turn my music down? Or will a cop see my hand move and think I'm trying to hide something? Should I get my license and registration out now? Put them on the dashboard so when he comes, I can already have my hands hanging out the window. Or if I open my glove compartment, will he think I'm going for a gun and then kill me? Those questions race through my mind so fast that I start to feel like I can't drive straight. I'll pull into the first gas station or strip mall I see, just so I can get off the road and calm down. And that's without the cop ever once flashing his lights at me. God forbid a cop actually does put on his blue lights and pull me over. It happened one morning recently when a cop pulled me over as I was coming out of the Holland Tunnel into New Jersey. Through my rearview mirror, I watched two cops get out of the car, one walking up to the driver's side, the other to the passenger side. They walked slowly, hands on hips, turning the tension up even higher. Damn, I thought as they approached. Getting taken out by a cop can really happen this fast. When one cop got to the driver's window, I already had both hands on the steering wheel. He asked for my license and registration, and I replied, "Is it okay if I reach for it?" He could hear the, "I don't want you to kill me for no damn reason" tone in my voice, so he said, "Sure," and then took my license. He went back to his car and ran it. I don't know how long it actually takes for police to run a license, but it seems to me like they like to milk the moment for all it's worth. They probably get the data in 30 seconds, but then they like to sit there and let you sweat a few more minutes just to remind you who's boss. For African Americans, this reminder is always a little more affecting. When a cop keeps you waiting in your car, the unsaid message seems to be, You ain't moving until we decide you're going to move. Slavery might be over, but you're not really free unless we say you are. That's a very chilling message to receive. In this case, the cops let me stew for a few minutes and then bought my license back. Make sure you don't drive too fast coming out the tunnel, the cop told me evenly, and then let me go. That was it. No ticket, no more drama. I should have been mad because I know for a fact I wasn't speeding. The cops were just running licenses in the hopes that they could catch someone with a warrant or expired plates. I should have complained for getting pulled over for no reason, but instead I actually told the cop, "Thank you, sir. I appreciate it." I was just happy I didn't get shot. For the rest of the ride, I had that anxious feeling in my chest, similar to how I used to feel back in Mount's Corner. The feeling that I had narrowly escaped a brush with a force looking to do me harm. I hate to admit it, but getting shot during a traffic stop is always in the back of my mind when I'm driving. It's PTSD from all we are living through. I feel like I'm stuck in this trauma partially because of the videos we see of unarmed black men and women getting murdered on TV. On one hand, I'm thankful the rest of the world is finally getting visual proof of what African Americans have always maintained. Cops often shoot black people for no good reason. I have to believe that over time, these images will make all the non-believers and skeptics out there get behind movements like Black Lives Matter and force the powers that be to make some real reform when it comes to how cops interact with African Americans. It's especially difficult when my wife and kids are with me. Suppose we get pulled over and a nervous officer mistakes my daughter's phone for a gun and shoots her. Suppose a cop pulls my wife out of her car Sandra Bland style and ends up killing her. I believe one of my jobs as a man is to protect my family, and the idea that a police officer could hurt them with me present freaks me out. If that was to happen, I know without a shadow of a doubt I am going to die in that moment because I'm not going to stand by and watch some cracker-ass, cracker racist cop physically assault my family. God forbid I'm ever in this situation. I try to switch my thoughts up when I feel myself dwelling on that possibility, but I find it very difficult to shut those scenarios out of my mind. To make matters worse, I start beating myself up for not being able to get out of my own head. Damn, man, you're weak, I tell myself. You're letting these devils get the best of you. Man the fuck up. Such is the irony of being black in America. You end up getting mad at yourself for not being better at dealing with the possibility that a government employee might kill you for no reason. These cops might not even be giving me a second thought, but I'm twisting myself in all sorts of emotional knots based on the possibility that they might. Whenever a new video comes out of a cop killing an African American, I try not to watch it, but I still feel myself drawn to it. Again, I don't think white people understand how devastating these images are. When you see people who look like you killed over and over again for no reason other than they look like you, it's impossible not to start thinking, one day I might be next. That's not paranoia. It's actually a very logical way to see things. I hate to make the analogy, but imagine if every time someone shot up a country music festival in Las Vegas or a movie theater in Colorado, we actually saw those murders on TV. The same way I saw Eric Garner getting choked out by cops on Staten Island or Walter Scott getting gunned down in South Carolina, that would be incredibly stressful and traumatic for a large part of the population. We don't see those images, though. We aren't shown white children or even white adults getting shot on TV. It's considered too disturbing for good reason. But when an African American gets shot, we're going to witness it over and over again. I pray those images lead to real change. But in the meantime, they're creating real damage. That's pretty much the definition of PTSD. Reliving traumatic events like they just happened. Finding yourself trapped by your fears day after day, year after year, even if they're no longer an immediate threat. Questioning myself. While cops make me instantly anxious, I've been fortunate to avoid blatant racism, unlike too many African Americans. I haven't been hit by as hard as blows. I'm pretty sure I have dealt with more covert racism than overt. The Klan never burned a cross on the lawn in front of our trailer or made my daddy disappear for not knowing his place. Just as no white man ever threatened me for talking to a white woman or called me a nigger, at least in my face. But growing up in South Carolina, I definitely felt that kind of energy in the air, like a fog that never quite lifted. I first sensed it, even if I couldn't name it, back in elementary school. One of my teachers, let's call her Miss Suspected White Supremacist, was definitely a racist. At the time, I thought she was just mean, but now I can see she really had it out for her black students. There was a black kid in our class named Alfred Copen, who was really poor. None of us were rich, but Alfred's family seemed to be doing even worse than everyone else's. His clothes looked like rags, he had holes in his sneakers, and he would sometimes smell. He also seemed to be hungry most of the time.